The coronavirus is the biggest threat this country has faced for decades.
We have asked everyone in Wales to make changes in the way we live our lives.
Stay at home during this pandemic.
Welcome to Journos in Lockdown,
a podcast created by trainee broadcast journalists who are learning to report in a global pandemic.
As we've not been able to go out and meet journalists, we've decided to bring them to you and ask them what challenges coronavirus has brought them
and what the future of journalism might look like.
Welcome to Journos in Lockdown. I'm Anthony Coote. Last month, I interviewed BBC Radio 5 Live and Radio Wales's Mark Hutchings. We discussed political reporting, about adapting reporting in lockdown, and how to stand out as a journalist. A note before we start. During this episode, I accidentally referred to the Welsh Parliament as the Welsh Assembly. It was renamed 2 weeks before this chat. I apologise for this error. Anyway, I hope you enjoy this episode. Welcome to Journos in Lockdown. Thank you, Mark Hutchings, for joining us. How are you?
I'm okay. I'm in the kitchen. You may be able to hear a slight kitcheny noise to what is my current bureau of operations. It's slightly different from what I'm used to, but I'm getting used to, this is the new normal, and it's a normal that's been going on for rather longer than any of us would have hoped.
Very true. Yeah, no, I must admit I'm recording from my own bedroom studio, for lack of a better phrase, right, with pillows behind me and that sort of thing, making the best of it, as we all are. So I thought we'd start with a sort of a background on yourself. And how did you get into journalism?
Well, a long, long time ago, back in the 1980s, and I had done a little bit of work on a placement for a weekly paper, the sort of which you don't really see very much of now. There are a few sort of clinging to the mast, but most of them have sunk since. But it was pretty good training, and I went to magistrates' courts and covered what were pretty piddly cases in the great scheme of things, but it was a great introduction to the law and to seeing a part of life that I hadn't seen before, and just getting used to the importance of getting things right, accuracy, which you know, all these decades on, I can't promise I always get it right, but it is the most important feature, I think, of any journalist's toolbox. I started my first proper job was on the Western Mail as a trainee, and then after that I went into independent radio in Wiltshire, and then back in Cardiff. Again, there were small independent operations where you basically did everything. So you did the news, sport, weather and travel. When I worked for Red Dragon in Cardiff, the studio was on one floor, the newsroom was on the floor above. And if you did the morning shift, you were entirely on your own, and you get the feed of the news coming in, you get all the carts as they then were all in order, and then you'd have about 10 minutes to turn around and grab all the sport feed coming through, and then you'd run downstairs and try and broadcast it. And sometimes you'd drop the cartridges on the way, as I did on a couple of occasions, then all be then out of order, which is obviously not something you get these days. You have technological hiccups these days, but dropping things and more falling out of order isn't so much of a problem. And then I started on BBC Radio, went into television, I presented Wales Today for a while, became Wales correspondent for the whole UK network on attachment for 6 months, and then 5 Live, which has been large, the biggest chunk of my career, covering various aspects across the whole of the UK. You know, and I went to Russia to cover the World Cup. When was that? A couple of years ago? A couple of summers ago? Seems like a lifetime ago now. And then most recently, I did a 18-month attachment in Westminster for BBC Wales as the parliamentary correspondent. And I'm now back working for 5 Live in my slightly echoey kitchen.
Fantastic. And how was that sort of contrast between working around the Welsh Parliament in Wales and working in Westminster? How did that sort of contrast for you?
Well, it is a world away. There were quite specific circumstances in that. So I went for what was meant to be 5 months and turned out to be 18 for various circumstances, but principally to cover the whole Brexit debate. So it was Parliament that, as you'd never seen it before, and in many respects, Parliament in paralysis, and that became the story, really. To some degree, I think it benefited me, because no one really had the faintest idea what was going on, it had to be said, and all those so-called meaningful votes were grinding to a halt, huge defeats for the government, Brexit apparently going nowhere, the whole process going round and round in circles. And I think, as coming in as a newcomer, if you like, it was a basic say what you see form of reporting initially, in terms as well as in terms of telling it to an audience, news. It was, I often refer to it as turning up at the scene of an accident and standing back and saying, well, what's happened here then? And then trying to recount and work out how they got into this particular fix. But then as it developed, obviously it was important to make contact with the MPs, particularly the Welsh MPs in my case. Some would tell you things in confidence that you could use. You had to be careful of those who are trying to, you know, use you for other reasons, perhaps, or to get a particular message out. But it's a question of building up trust between you and them, and then able to, as a consequence, pick up stories from it.
So is that the sort of advice you'd give to any journalist put into political reporting, is to build up those relationships and that sort of level of trust with MPs who might be a source of stories or useful in debates?
Absolutely. And I would also say, and it is something I think that's developed in recent years, is that, you know, at the risk of sounding like an old fuddy-duddy, younger people in particular don't have as much direct verbal or physical contact with other people and people they're reporting on, because it's so easy now to send off a WhatsApp note or a text or an email or whatever. Whereas, you know, when I started, there was only one way of getting hold of people. Well, two ways. You could either run out in the street and jump in front of people, or you ring them up. And that contact makes a heck of a difference, I think, because in a WhatsApp message, you can't see a raising of the eyebrow, or, you know, you might get the odd emoji, you might give a bit of a clue, but, you know, you can't get a sense of what people, reading between the lines, if you like. And also people will tell you things face to face, whereas perhaps they don't want it put down in print, in whatever form of print that is. So there is no substitute, I think, for actually meeting or people or speaking to them. So I would certainly recommend that. And then, yeah, building up that element of trust, knowing that you will get things right, that you will honour an arrangement between you. I mean, you don't want to be used by them, but it has to be a sort of an understanding that you can be trusted and that you can trust them too. And you soon learn which ones are spinning you a bit of a yarn. And, you know, the best politicians, the best MPs know that sometimes they simply have to take the rough with the smooth, because you can build up a good relationship with a good contact, and then every now and again you've got to do a story that doesn't show them in a terribly good light. And the best politicians take that on the chin.
Well, that's really fascinating. It's really interesting to sort of hear about those sort of complex relationships between journalists and politicians. Obviously, you've covered both Westminster and the Welsh Government and the Welsh Assembly. When it comes to devolved issues compared to Westminster, do you have to sort of work harder to sort of gain audience attention outside of Wales when reporting that on the radio?
Yes. I mean, I'm what time is it? In about an hour and 20 minutes, I'm going on 5 Live to talk about the Welsh Government's plans, such as they are, for the return to school for pupils, which is very much more vague than what they're saying in England. But the Welsh Government make the argument that they don't want to get tied down by dates, which is a bit of a knot that the UK government have got in over schools in England. Obviously, I have to put that over. I mean, I always have to acknowledge that, you know, there are 60-odd million people in the UK. Only 3 million of them are Welsh or living in Wales. So there's a numerical imbalance, undoubtedly, but it's important that you get over the message that things often are different in Wales, not always, but often. And also there's an element of compare and contrast. I mean, the story of organ donations has come up again in England, and Wales was the first to go down that line of assumed consent, presumed consent for organ donors. And, you know, when something is tried out in one nation, it's quite beneficial for everybody, the whole audience, to find out how it happened when it comes to introducing a policy in a different part of the UK. I think this is the biggest test for devolution, undoubtedly. It's the most important decisions the Welsh Government have ever had to make, and also it's a big test of the media's coverage of it, which has often been virtually non-existent, apart from notable exceptions, up to now, and is still rather patchy. But it's a learning process, and some people are on a pretty steep learning curve, I think.
I'm sure that people will be quite interested to hear about the virtual element. Obviously, the Welsh Assembly has had a lot of sort of virtual meetings, and how that's made it more difficult for a political reporter to sort of get into these meetings. Sort of, what's your experience been of that?
Well, I think in some respects you can snoop around a bit more, and you can look at people's reactions, and in some respects it has that element of I don't want to use the phrase peeping Tom, but you know, you're sort of it's like a window on something. But also the interaction is obviously taken away, because you're dialing in just as they are. There are, you know, inevitably glitches involved. It's more stilted. You know, the incident the other week where the Welsh Health Minister forgetting to mute his mic and not minding his P's, Q's or F's So it can go slightly awry. I mean, at the moment, there's a novelty value, let's be honest about it, albeit the endless family Zoom quizzes are probably putting a swift end to that novelty. And then in Westminster, particularly, you know, they've had some issues with the House of Lords, some older members having a few difficulties dialing in successfully. But it probably then forced them to come up to speed a little bit and move into the era of modern technology, albeit there are moves afoot to try and move back from this hybrid system to get them all packing the benches. It's undoubtedly a different atmosphere in Westminster. If you watch Prime Minister's Questions, it is more like a courtroom than the pantomime that some people sometimes refer to it, and that obviously plays to different strengths among the relevant politicians.
Yeah, I must admit, a pantomime is an excellent descriptor of the previous Prime Minister's Questions. I was wondering, you were recently obviously covering one of the first court proceedings in Wales since Corona started. What was that experience like for you, sort of outside sort of regular court reporting?
Well, it was fascinating, really. One benefit was that it got me out of the house and actually something to go. But I've lost count of the number of court cases I've covered in all courts, and particularly at Cardiff Crown Court. But just to go in there and to, you know, follow the taped lines of the one-way system, it was a case that was stretched out over two courts. So the main court had the defendant, the judge and the barristers and the jury, and then there was the overflow court, which had the press, some lawyers, CPS police, a clerk and the members of the public that were there, also some family members of the defendant, all relayed by screen. The case I covered, it was quite a simple case. They would struggle to have a complicated case, a multi-handed case, in those circumstances, but it worked reasonably well. Obviously, these are extreme circumstances. But again, I mean, a bit like Westminster, it's interesting to see the judiciary, which is rooted in tradition and wigs and reams of documents and all the trappings of an ageing process, having to come up to speed and to realise this new normal directly impacts on them and try to adapt to it to speed up what has historically been a painfully slow judicial system anyway.
So sort of in reference to obviously how we've discussed the changes in reporting in Corona, are there any other parts of the job that have changed since lockdown that you've noticed specifically?
Well, I mean, the most obvious element is how Wi-Fi dependent we all now are, and the reason I'm in this echoey kitchen is that I've got three of the members of the family sharing their own elements of Wi-Fi working from home. It's perhaps easier to get hold of people because you know where they are, largely at home, and because of, you know, different methods of working, I mean, like we're doing now, it's easier to record people. So that's undoubtedly changed. I've probably picked up more local stories in my own street as a consequence of just talking more to the neighbours and getting, you know, little angles on what often seem to be political stories and how it's impacting on their lives. And you know, it's that we can perhaps lose sight of that sometimes, that the greatest illustrations of a story can be under your own nose from individuals' experiences of them, case studies. So I've definitely spoken more to my neighbours than in many a year, and I've picked up quite a few stories as a consequence from them. So there's that element, which brings it right back almost to my days of starting on local newspapers.
That's really interesting. I mean, it's quite interesting to see sort of, obviously, journalists prior to lockdown and currently in lockdown will be using Twitter a lot to sort of seek out stories, and you seem to use Twitter very well to seek out sort of public questions and opinion for broadcast, as well as promoting some of the times you're on programmes. Do you think social media has become even more important during lockdown to journalists, and how would you suggest young journalists use it?
Carefully is how I would suggest all journalists should use social media. I suppose, I don't know that it's become more important, but it is, I mean, it's been a crucial part of what journalists have to do for a few years now, and you have to be selective as to how you use it. I mean, I'm lucky in that I don't tend to get a huge amount of abuse. Occasionally I get the odd bit of abuse from somebody, but I can understand why some people, and particularly I'm afraid a lot of young female journalists, suffer from an absurd amount of appalling reaction. But the plus points are evident. You can get a message out there, and I suppose, I mean, to go back to the question about devolution, I have been able to a wider audience than I would perhaps be able to or a different audience from the one I get on air to get over the message that Wales is different. And I don't know whether I can claim credit for this or not, but the number 10 Twitter site, or UK Prime Minister's called Twitter site, were putting out over the weekend the regulations are this, you can meet someone from outside your own house as long as it's only one person, blah, blah, blah. And it didn't say in England. So I kept retweeting it with comments saying in England. And in the end, I emailed them. And 20 minutes later, the next tweet had in England in it. Now, that may have been about to happen anyway. I'd like to think that, you know, it was my heroic efforts to get accuracy out on that Twitter account that had an impact. But I mean, certainly that sort of contact, that sort of message you wouldn't have been able to get through pre-social media. I'd just be going out in the street and shouting it at people. So that has definitely been a benefit that you can push a message. Because, well, I mean, when you think about it, the consequences of a Downing Street Twitter account telling people they could do something that was actually against the law in Wales, I mean, not actively saying you can do it in Wales, but by omission suggesting you could, you know, it's potentially quite serious. So it's quite good being able to stick a sort of poke someone in the ribs over that.
That's really interesting. So sort of in relation to some of the promotional side of Twitter and sort of putting your best stuff on there, because obviously there's a lot of there's the video function as well. Do you think that's sort of essential, that you sort of constantly put the most engaging content up on Twitter in line with your work?
To a degree, I mean, I think, and from what I'm told, is there's very little crossover between a social media audience and a mainstream audience, if you like, a traditional media audience. So, I mean, I do say, as I have now, that I'll be on 5 Live after 6 talking about whatever, on the basis that a few people might tune in. Very few, from what I'm told, actively do that. But there's also another element of promotion about it anyway, I think, if that you can, and again, reaching out to politicians and showing to those critics who say that the BBC doesn't reflect Wales sufficiently, even if they don't actually listen, if they can see a read a message that you're doing it, you know, that gets that message out there. So I do take advantage of that. Facebook I tend to keep for more personal stuff, social stuff, rather than work stuff. Occasionally I put something on Facebook, but Facebook still has by far the biggest audience of any social media. And then separately, there are, I mean, all the news organisations now have their own bespoke content that they'll put out, because there is a difference, and BBC are meant to caption everything. I mean, it can be a bit of a frustration at the moment. You might have a good video or a good clip of somebody, and if it's to go and under a BBC identity, it has to be subtitled. Whereas I sometimes just want to put it out there as soon as I possibly can, and then maybe subtitle it later. But, you know, there can be those barriers in the way of getting something out as quickly as you might want. I can understand why they're there, but that can be a bit of a frustration.
That's the interesting thing of, you know, ease of access, and whether it's about ease of access, or if it's people obviously not listening themselves and just watching it as a video with subtitles per se.
Yeah, most people don't. The argument is most people don't listen to the sound. They'll just, I mean, maybe they're not able to play out the sound because it'll disturb somebody, or they get in the habit of not doing it either. I mean, I still, even now, when I occasionally cover court cases where there's a big court case with a verdict, it is still the most terrifying thing to tweet guilty, because you doubt yourself and you know it's right. But in, you know, pre-social media, pre-Twitter, particularly if you file copy, there would be a barrier. You file the copy, someone else would read it and put it out. So if you copped it up and got the wrong verdict, I mean, I don't think I ever have, but there's a sort of extra comfort blanket. But when you are at that very second writing guilty, your blood pressure does go up through the roof a bit. You think, he is guilty, isn't he? I mean, a bit like being on air on the radio as well, or on television, because, you know, once you've said it, it's hard, you can't really say, no, actually, I didn't mean that. But I think it's worse than that, because obviously, as soon as somebody's seen it on Twitter and they maybe retweet it, then you can't, it's a runaway train then, really. So, yeah, as much as I use Twitter, there is still that moment every now and again, my heart beats a little bit faster. Am I doing the right thing?
And sort of on that side, have you had, or do you know of any particularly sort of large technical issues or disasters that have been linked to sort of these lockdown adaptations in broadcasting? Sort of any interesting stories? Is that?
I'm not talking about broadcasting. I mentioned the cable mics being left open by Vaughan Gething and effing when he shouldn't have done. I'm not. I mean, we've all a lot of. Broadcasters, particularly some who've got used to some traditional methods of working, and I think it's where, you know, people like yourself coming in are at an advantage over people like me, because you're already using all sorts of different apps and different ways of broadcasting, where those of us who've been doing it for decades, you get used to a way of working that follows a formula. You know how to to get on air, and then suddenly half of that's taken away, and you're faffing around a bit trying to work out how to do it. So, I mean, I know of some programs that are being presented from people's living rooms where they barely used any form of modern technology in the last 20 years, you know. So I think it's been a bit of a jar for some broadcasters. But also, I mean, that has shown you what can be done quite easily. I mean, haven't got with me now, but I've got an old lip mic that I use as a football commentator, and I've had it for donkey's years. It cuts out all other noise, and I largely use it because I've got all these other noises around the house, other people working in it. But there are far better quality mics you can now get if you've got the right set of circumstances. And then this whole thing about putting soft furnishings around and all that sort of stuff. So it has, I think, for many of us been a bit of a learning experience to try and shake off your tried and tested methods of doing it and trying a different way. But, you know, that's quite liberating, I suppose.
On the sort of topic of changes, what changes do you think will be kept after lockdown from this sort of technological side and other things?
From broadcasting or the whole sort of just...
From broadcasting.
Who knows? It may be. Well, I think it'll undoubtedly be the case that all of us, and including journalists and broadcasters, will work from home more than we did. I think there will be an acknowledgement. There will have to be an acknowledgement for a while yet that people will have to do that. And maybe then it's accepted that you don't all have to file in to share the same offices. And that is sort of awakening of the sort of different technological ways of doing things and the ease of recording interviews like this. Hopefully successfully. So yeah, I think, you know, that sort of genie's out of the lamp on that, and that's forced people to think outside the box, perhaps, and it's forced people to think imaginatively about how you can get hold of somebody. And, you know, and I've just been doing some simple interviews just by sending audio WhatsApp questions to somebody and they send an answer back, and it's amazing how quick and effective that can be. So I think that sort of element will stay. Hopefully what we don't lose, and, you know, to go back to the point I was making earlier, I hope we don't lose completely the need to get in touch with people and to meet people and have quite a little chat with people, because it was, you know, increasingly people moving away from that. Well, if we've got into a habit of we don't meet anyone apart from people in the same household, then maybe that is a negative, potential negative that we'd have to overcome, I think.
Yeah, that's very true. I mean, in the ideas of access and that sort of thing, what do you think are the key advantages of radio when it comes to reporting, especially in this crisis?
Well, I think, radio is the oldest form of broadcast media. I mean, it's rumours of its death have been exaggerated for about the last 40, 50 years, I suppose, and particularly in the last few years. I think podcasts have given radio a new lease of life, and I still count podcasts as part of it's radio. It's a different format, and the style is different, but it still has that intimacy that I think you can only get on radio, and certainly you can't really get on television. So I think that's been a huge boost, and in terms of reaching new audiences as well, particularly younger audiences, I think I'm not entirely convinced that podcasts reach sufficiently out, at least yet, to a socially diverse audience. I think there's a high element of, should we call them, young professionals listening, and maybe a lot of work needs to be done in expanding, you know, that reach. But, you know, radio remains, in many respects, the easiest form of broadcasting. There are plenty of people who've got stories to tell and they don't want to be seen. They hate seeing pictures of themselves. And there's no other barrier in the way. And if you go out and do a television report, and particularly if you're you've got a camera there, particularly if you've got another person, some people love it, other people hate it. And radio, you know, when it works best, it's just you and the interviewee. You've got a bit more time, you can run things longer. And again, I think podcasts help that and let things breathe a little bit more. And so hopefully lockdown, you know, it may have reminded a lot of people of the benefits of radio. And also, when you think about an older generation, and, you know, I think of people like my mother, who's in her 80s, and sometimes, you know, a lot of networks, they don't really want to chase that audience because it's sort of there, and they're all going to go eventually, and it's all people are concerned about where's the new audience coming in. But maybe it has been a reminder that to mainstream media, and particularly radio, has still got a vital role to play in information. My mother's not on Twitter, she's not reading what I or anybody else has to say about this. She still needs important information from tried and tested methods, and radio, I think, still remains top of the tree for that.
So following on from that, do you think that the trust in the mainstream media has sort of been helped by the crisis in that respect, especially amongst young people?
You would hope so. We shall see. Brexit was a difficult subject, and we'll come back again to cover for mainstream media, I think, the election and Brexit. And the amount of abuse I've had, I think of my own experience in the last few years, have been greater than the total abuse I've had in the 30 years prior to it, I would say. I remember, when it started, it was during the miners' strike, and you get a bit of abuse from some miners, because I worked for the Western Mail, and it had the reputation of being the coal owners' newspaper. So you had a bit of accusations that you were biased, shouted at you on the picket line, but that was about, that was about it, really. Whereas now, and particularly with social media, the abuse over Brexit was there, and College Green, where I spent a lot of my time, you had a lot of people just shouting at you. One shouted, I said I was from the BBC, and one protester said, F off, you treacherous scum. We'd only just met. He wasn't a great student of my work. It just the words of the BBC. And you can't, there's no argument, there's no debate to be had there. So that was unpleasant, I think. And lockdown, I think it changed at the beginning of lockdown because people desperately needed basic information, what is happening. And if you look at the graphs, BBC, whatever you think of it, is still, BBC News is still the most visited place to get information. So I think some trust came back there, but I don't delude myself that it stretches everywhere. And certainly after a while, obviously, once that information, important information comes out, and then people start to debate whether it's right or not and whether policies are right or not. And that's where you see the accusations of political bias, either pro or anti, that we're pro the government or anti the government or whichever government you're talking about. So I think it's tilted back a bit, hopefully not too much. And again, there's a danger that if you go on Twitter of thinking that's entirely representative of the world at large, where it isn't. And storms that break out on Twitter can often be storms in a Twitter teacup, and that people in the wider world have the faintest idea what the whole row was about.
Very true. Well, that's unfortunately the sort of double-edged sword that you have as a journalist, and the sort of unfortunate abuse that you sometimes get, because people obviously have their own opinions and are entitled to them. So on a more positive note, what is the best piece of sort of corona-themed journalism that you've seen, excluding your own, during this crisis?
Well, I think there are many ways of telling a story. The thing I found most rewarding was a couple of weeks ago when I made contact with the father of a boy with autism about how it was affecting them. And they live in Cardiff, and for years his regular routine has been going to see Cardiff Market being locked up for the night, and they ring a bell, and he films everything himself on his phone. And so I made contact with them and had a chat, and his dad said, well, we still make the market part of our walk, but now we just go and look at it already shut. We don't see the process of it being shut. So I chatted to them, and we arranged that they would do some record some links as they went around, and the father and son got a great relationship. And I put that out as a bit of audio and a video without me in it at all, and I thought that spoke greater than a thousand words of reporting, really. I saw other versions of it where it was packaged up in more traditionally, with a bit of commentary on it, explaining what autism was, etc., etc., which you could do. I just thought it took away some of the charm and some of the chemistry between the father and son, just letting something breathe, allowing for the repetition that does come with with autism, that sort of people with autism do sort of repeat themselves quite a lot. But that, particularly with this boy, was part of the quality of it, if you like, and how his father reacted to that. And they sang Ghost Town as well as part of it, I thought it was incredibly rewarding to be part of. And unless I went around telling everybody, no one had the faintest idea I had any part in it, apart from an earlier broadcast when I sort of cued into it. But sometimes you just have to stand back and let a story tell itself, not be too precious about being owning it and being part of it. So it's not necessarily the big story. Sometimes the most rewarding ones are just give you a little snapshot on humanity.
Now that's really touching, and really is really good. It's a really good piece of advice for obviously young journalists to sort of step back and obviously avoid making themselves part of the story. And on that note, and sort of on a final note, have you got any other advice for young journalists at this particularly difficult time, especially if they're looking for work?
Well, I appreciate obviously there are huge financial challenges for news organisations at the moment, and as a consequence, as a ripple effect of that, for any journalists trying to break into the profession, and it is particularly sad, I think, for some of those newspapers that are plugging away there. And there are some really good examples of those who've made themselves really community-based newspapers who really are facing financial struggles, and hopefully they can survive. So I think my advice, probably just for in any era of journalism, you have to try and stand out a bit. You've got to put a bit of personality into your journalism without letting it take over, a bit of individuality. I think perhaps, you know, a bonus of what's happening now, as I say, we've all learned various ways of doing things and how easily some things can be done. I mean, you can put together a showcase of your work far more than I could have done when I was your age. So you can push out examples of what you are able to do and how you can work around difficulties, because we've all had to come up with cunning plans of ways of getting around these rules and restrictions. So if you can show that your journalism has worked around that, then that's has to be a good example. And particularly, as I say, if you can show that you've made contact with individuals, you've got their stories, because I think lockdown has illustrated how many individual little stories there are dotted here, there and everywhere to tell a far bigger story about, you know, the picture that affects everybody. Sometimes, you know, it's the detail that tells the big story.
Fantastic. Well, that has been incredibly informative and really, really interesting. I'm sure our viewers are very appreciative of the time you've given up and your fantastic advice. So I want to thank you very much for coming on Journos in Lockdown. And hopefully we will, obviously, they'll go and see more of you on your various social platforms. Do you want to tell them sort of where they can find you in that sense?
Well, I've got Mark Hutchings with a G1 is my Twitter account, at Mark Hutchings, MarkHutchings1 is my Twitter account. So you can look at there my various ramblings, and I can be heard regularly on 5 Live. Of course, if you want to listen to mainstream radio, it's still there, alive and sort of kicking.
Fantastic. So catch you on BBC Sounds or obviously on traditional
BBC
radio
Sounds,
there.
Of course, yeah.
You've been listening to Journos in Lockdown. Thanks again to Mark Hutchings for talking to me in this episode. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter. We're at Lockdown Journos. And tune in for the next episode, where Gareth will be chatting to award-winning Wales Online political editor and Western Mail journalist Will Hayward. And in the meantime, stay safe.